From former President Bush to Oprah Winfrey, the Ice Bucket Challenge has raised buckets of cash. But what difference has it made for ALS? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, two Iowans tell us about the loved ones they've lost to ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, and we'll get their reactions to the Ice Bucket Challenge craze. Dr. Andrea Swenson of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics will tell us about the disease, current research, and the impact this windfall of donations may make. Have you or your family been touched by ALS? What do you think of the Ice Bucket Challenge? First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, with everyone from former President George W. Bush to Justin Bieber and Shakira posting these online videos of themselves dumping buckets of ice over their heads in the name of charity, the viral Ice Bucket Challenge continues to dominate social media. Perhaps you've done it as well. It has now raised more than $60 million for ALS, commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease. Donations to the ALS Association, it's a Washington-based nonprofit that funds global research to find treatments and a cure for the disease, have surged since the challenge started trending on social media in late July. This hour, we want to talk with two Iowans who have lost loved ones to ALS. And we'll get their reactions to the Ice Bucket Challenge as well. Also, Dr. Andrea Swenson of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics is with us to tell us about the disease, about some current research, and the impact that this windfall of donations may have. We also want to reach out to you this hour, River to River listeners. Have you or your family been touched by ALS? What do you think of this Ice Bucket Challenge? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining us initially from our Des Moines studio, Rekha Basu, columnist for the Des Moines Register. Hello, Rekha.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We invited you on. You're well known across Iowa, but we also invited you on because your husband, Rob Borsellino, who also worked at the Register, was diagnosed in 2004 mm-hmm. with ALS. He died about a year and a half later, and I want to thank you for coming on the show today to share that story with us so that we may know what that experience is like, and you can raise our awareness about this disease. Can you just start off by telling us when Rob started to display symptoms and what they were?
Yes, I can actually pinpoint it to one exact weekend that was around the weekend of Halloween in 2004. It was my older son had gone off to college. He was a freshman at Amherst College in Massachusetts, and Rob had gone down for the first parents' visiting weekend. I wasn't able to go because of some work commitments. And I remember Rob was staying with my sister in Massachusetts, and she called me and said, "Is something wrong with Rob's voice? Because I noticed that he's having trouble getting speech out, getting language out." And I just sort of laughed and said, "No, you know, there's nothing wrong with him. He's fine." And I was talking to him, and I guess his voice was a little bit slurry. He came back and told me that some strange things were happening to him, that he was having trouble sometimes getting speech out, and that he was having trouble with one of his hands, just turning screws on bottles, opening a bottle of Coke. And at first, you know, we both just kind of shrugged it off and thought it was nothing. And then I mentioned it to a friend who said, "You know, you should take him to a hospital because maybe he's having a stroke." And so I took him to the emergency room, and they did a variety of tests. They couldn't figure out anything. They sent him to a neurologist. And by the end of that week, which I think is rare, they had a positive diagnosis for ALS. Often it takes a lot longer to get diagnoses. I'm told it can take a year or several years. I've read stories of people whose cases took that long to diagnose.
What was that moment like to get the diagnosis? for you and for Rob and the rest of your family?
It was paralyzing. I mean, I remember the first question I asked. We were sitting together in the doctor's office, and I just said, my first question was, will it hurt? Will there be pain? And he said, no, there's no pain. And then he said, but, you know, gradually you lose your ability to speak, to eat, to walk, to talk, to swallow, to breathe. And we just sat there numb, and I remember driving home in the car together, and we couldn't even talk. We were in such shock. And I guess for a while we were in denial as well, because we kept going to doctor after doctor to try to get a different diagnosis. We mm-hmm. went up to Iowa City. We went to Columbia Presbyterian in New York. We went to Johns Hopkins in Maryland. We just kept going to different hospitals, and they all put him through the same tests, and they all said the same thing. And the thing that was so stunning is that, you know, I kept saying, well, there must be a treatment. There must be a cure. But there was nothing. The only medication that there was, which cost about $900 a month, was Ryliotec, which could possibly extend your life by 2 to 3 months over the span of the whole illness. And, you know, quite frankly, I think that some doctors, it was so relatively rare that some doctors had not really learned how to be compassionate in dealing with patients. And we were just basically told, get ready to go home and die. There's nothing you can do.
What was the outlook in terms of months or years that Rob was given?
They said 2 to 5 years was the average. And as I understand it, his case, because it started in the throat, was already determined to be one of the faster moving cases, because, of course, that has implications for breathing and swallowing. Some other people start in the legs, in the arms, and so that's not quite as life-threatening. But he was given 2 to 5 years, and he went in 1.5. He just got weaker and weaker. It really, really went fast.
I know it must be horrible to go back over these memories, but you're communicating to us something very significant and important in understanding ALS.
Well, thank you. It's painful, of course, every time I think about it, but I never don't think about it. You know, mm-hmm. it's always on my mind.
Tell me about that rapid decline in Rob. What were some moments that you can recall for us that will make it clear what ALS can be?
You know, Rob had said from the beginning that he didn't want any artificial measures to keep him alive at the end. He didn't want tubes implanted in his throat or in his stomach. He did not want to be on a ventilator. He wanted to be a fully participating member of society. And the thing about ALS, the reason why it's called a locked-in disease, is that, of course, there's no cognitive decline in most cases. There certainly wasn't in Rob's. He was fully functioning and aware and engaged with the world mentally, but just gradually he lost the ability to do things. First, little things like pulling on his shoes, opening a bottle cap. Eventually, he had trouble standing, and he would take falls. And several times I was at work, and he fell and hit his head and was bleeding, and the kids were home, and they called ambulances. He really didn't want to be in a wheelchair. I mean, he really didn't want to live a compromised life. But as it became clear that he was having trouble eating, you know, we realized that he was going to die way ahead of when he had to, unless he got a feeding tube. So he relented and got a feeding tube in his stomach. And then, you know, we had to feed him that way several times a day through a liquid diet. They said at first, you know, you can both enjoy the taste of food a little bit, but also do this for nutrition. And he was a very, very thin person to begin with. So he could get weak very quickly unless we maintained his nutrition.
What about the point of revealing this? You and your husband, Rob Borsellino, are public figures. How did you talk about how to reveal this to your readers of the Register?
Well, the first thing was we had to reveal it to our children, and that was the toughest. And we didn't want anyone to know until the kids knew. And that was the thing that I was just paralyzed with fear about doing. The older son, Raj, was away, as I mentioned, at college in Massachusetts. And so his diagnosis came on November the 4th. And we waited until Christmas break when Raj was home to assemble both the kids. And we sat down, you know, on our bed and said, look, this is what's happened and this is what he's got. And
had they noticed symptoms by that point too?
You know, I don't think they really had. I mean, they live so much in their own worlds. One was in going into high school and the other was in college, and they hadn't seen him up close. And I hadn't either. I mean, I really hadn't, you know, because when you see someone day to day, you don't notice these little changes. Other people were noticing them more. And actually, you know, Rob did some TV, and we heard later that viewers had said, why is he slurring his voice? Is he drinking again? Now, Rob had not at the time had a drink for 20 years. It was something that he was very proud of. He gave up drinking before we got married and just never, I mean, took his last drink and never looked back. And so the idea that people thought he was drinking again, you know, was sort of hurtful. And he didn't really understand what was going on either. Neither one of us knew much about ALS. All we knew was that it was named after Lou Gehrig, a Yankee, and Rob was a Yankees fan, and that was pretty much it. How we decided to tell the public, well, I guess after we told the kids, which was very difficult, Rob wrote a column about it. And the paper, the Des Moines Register, ran it on the front page. And the headline of it was, I Can Kick the Denial, Not the Disease. And he talked about how he had been in denial about it, and about the symptoms and about the diagnosis and how, you know, we kept looking for other doctors to give us a different one. And then he talked about, you know, and it was Rob's signature style was humorous. And so he did it with a lot of humor. He talked about how, you know, here it is, you know, first of all, his waistline is getting fatter and his hair is getting thinner and, you know, he's getting older and he's approaching 60. He was only 54 years old at the time. And now I got this, you know, a terminal disease. And when it ran, I mean, the minute it hit newsstands and people's doorsteps, the phone started ringing and friends were crying and said, you know, how come we didn't know this? And it was just, I mean, it was painful because every time you tell another person about it, it makes it more real, you know, it makes it more concrete. So it was also
picked up by national media.
Yeah. So Aaron Brown, who ran a talk show on CNN, pulled up that front page of the Des Moines Register that day and said and showed it to his readers. And then he said he had gotten so much feedback, he wanted to know more. He wanted to interview Rob in person. So Rob flew down to their studios in New York and did like a 20-minute segment with him about it. And it got a tremendous amount of response.
Mm-hmm. Also on in the New York Times, Washington Post, also on NPR.
Yes.
If you've just joined us, Rekha Basu is my guest columnist for the Des Moines Register, talking about her husband, also the Des Moines Register columnist, Rob Borsellino, diagnosed in 2004 with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. He died a year and a half later, and we're talking about ALS today, of course, because of the success of the Ice Bucket Challenge. I want to ask Rekha about that in just a moment, but before we go to that point, I want to have us introduce Dr. Andrea Swenson. Dr. Swenson is a doctor of neuromuscular disorders at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, joining us by phone. Dr. Swenson, hello.
For inviting me.
Great to have you with us. Now, Rekha has been telling us the very personal side of this disease, how it progressed through one person and eventually killed Rob Borsellino. Tell us what was going on inside of his body, anyone's body who is struck with ALS.
So we at this point don't know a lot about why ALS starts and why it starts in certain people, but as far as what the disease is doing, it's primarily affecting the motor neurons, which are located throughout the spinal cord and also the brainstem. And those motor neurons eventually go out to the motor nerves, which then go to the muscle. And as those motor neurons start to die off, the motor nerves die off, and that eventually causes the muscles to become very weak and atrophic or shrunken looking. And that eventually leads to paralysis. As far as when ALS starts in a person, we don't really know, but it's thought that at least a third of the motor neurons and motor nerves need to die off before people actually notice symptoms.
Mm-hmm. So he was something was going on long before these symptoms in October of 2004 started?
Most likely, yeah. Yeah, we again, it's not certain exactly when things started, but there are hypotheses that something's going on before people recognize it.
Mm-hmm. What do we know about the or you said not much, but go into that about the origins, the causes of ALS. Is it genetics, diet, lifestyle, a mix?
There's a lot of hypotheses out there, and I think when you look into the literature about it, you probably could say all of above applies right now. One of the leading theories is that whomever gets ALS has something in their own personal genetic makeup that's making them susceptible to eventually develop the disease. And throughout their life, they're probably exposed to something in the environment that then triggers the disease in them. Mm-hmm. And what that exposure is, it's not quite sure, but there is research being done on possibilities such as a virus or a chemical. Maybe there's something in that person's lifestyle that they did, for example, their occupation or the sports that they did or not did. And so there's a study that we're part of right now that's looking more into those types of risk factors. Is smoking a risk factor?
Can you find out, though, if you are genetically predisposed to ALS?
Well, there are certain genetic tests for what's called familial ALS that are available. And again, looking at the types of ALS, familial probably occurs in about 10% of cases. The rest of them are what's called sporadic. And the sporadic is what we don't really have a test for as far as looking at the genetics.
Mm-hmm. Rekha recounted, Rob, her husband's diagnosis there, going to the doctor just 10 years ago. And a lot of questions still remain. It's how rare is this disease?
Well, it occurs in anywhere from 2 to 7 people per 100,000. So it's not too common.
Are we seeing any trends there, increasing trends of people?
It is increasing as far as the numbers go, and whether that has to do with more recognition of what ALS is and looks like, whether it's related to aging population, it's not known, but those numbers are going up.
You said there's so many questions about it, and obviously much to be discovered about this disease in conquering it. Why is it such a difficult disease? Do we know, to understand?
Well, ALS falls into this category called neurodegeneration or neurodegenerative diseases, which also include Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, Huntington's disease, a lot of diseases where neurodegeneration, meaning dying off of brain cells or other cells throughout the nervous system is occurring. And there's a lot of research in those diseases as well to figure out exactly what is causing neurodegeneration. And I think it's a lot of different things going on and a lot of different mechanisms that need to explore as to exactly what's happening with those things. But I think that's what makes it difficult is it's a pretty complex system.
Okay, we're talking about ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease this hour. The viral ice bucket challenge continues to dominate social media, now raising more than $60 million for the ALS Association. Rekha Basu, tell us, how have you observed and traced this ice bucket challenge? did you initially think, oh, this is nice, having so much fun with a disease that killed my husband?
No, that was not my reaction. I mean, as with most things that have to do with social media and new technologies, I heard about it first from my younger son, who's very savvy to all that stuff, and he told me about the challenge, and I almost couldn't believe it because, you know, ALS has just not been a part of the popular parlance. People really have not talked about it very much. It hasn't been well known. It hasn't been addressed. There's been no cure. It's been so stagnant. And the fact that more and more people were taking this challenge and challenging others, I was so excited, frankly. And I know that some people don't think it's a very dignified way to address a really hideous disease, but I think the more attention to it, the better. And I also think that, you know, it is such a hideous disease that it's really difficult to even talk about. And so to be able to do something that adds a little levity to the subject, I think, is really a positive development. Mm-hmm. And so many people, from, you know, unknown people to top politicians, as you mentioned earlier, are taking part in it, and people are having fun with it. And I now keep hearing that people did it using Rob's name, you know, doing it in memory of him. And I find that so inspiring. Now, I know one of the things that has come up is that people can do it in lieu of paying $100 or making a contribution to ALS. And I think that it would be nice if they did both, obviously, because, you know, they need a lot more money. And that has clearly been happening. I think a lot of people are doing both because, as I understand it, something like, at last count, $70 million has been raised for ALS.
Yeah, somewhere between 60 and 70, and it's moving as we talk here, upward. Yeah, but I'm wondering, because you have your first contact with ALS in the form of your husband's diagnosis in 2004, mm-hmm. what sort of awareness raising have you tracked in the last decade?
Well, you know, I'll tell you just sort of anecdotally that the first year I went to a walk for ALS, it was out in Jordan Creek around the pond, and there were maybe 75 people there. And this was right after Rob's death in 2006. At most, I'd say 100. And then a couple of years ago, I went to one at Principal Park, and there were just thousands and thousands of people, and so many people carrying signs of loved ones in this community who had died from it. And I was just stunned, because when Rob was diagnosed, really most people we talked to didn't know a thing about it, didn't know what it was, and everybody was jumping on the internet and, you know, Googling it and trying to do research about it, as I was. I spent so much time just online looking for information and for cures. And now a lot of people know someone who has been struck by it. And that's not a good thing. But on the other hand, there is a growing awareness of how important it is to find a cure. And I get calls really quite often from somebody, either a reader or a friend, a distant friend who knows someone who's just been diagnosed and is feeling as shell-shocked as Rob and I were in the beginning, and wanting to sit down and talk and wanting tips about how to cope. And mm-hmm. I often meet with people and just talk to them, or talk to them on the phone about what I know.
Dr. Andrea Swenson, we have a minute or so before we go to break, and I'm glad you'll be with us for the rest of the hour, but I want to get your initial reaction as a doctor of neuromuscular disorders at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. How have you tracked this ice bucket challenge? What have you had different reactions, or from the get-go, did you see it as a positive thing?
Yeah, I think it's been a positive thing. Not only has it been raising money, but I think the awareness is really important, too. This disease isn't very common, and I think raising awareness not only alerts people to what the disease is, but also if they might be having symptoms, and getting them checked out sooner rather than waiting.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about what is the importance of raising awareness from your perspective.
I think what we would like is for people to get diagnosed sooner. We do have a multidisciplinary clinic for patients with ALS, and that's one thing that has actually been shown to improve quality of life as well as patient survival. And getting people into those clinics as soon as we can is really good for them.
Okay, Dr. Andrea Swenson, a doctor of neuromuscular disorders at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Rekha Basu, columnist for the Des Moines Register, with us, thankfully, telling us so that we may better understand ALS about her husband, who was diagnosed in 2004 and died about a year and a half later. When we come back, we'll talk with another person who had a loved one struck down by ALS. Perhaps you can join us with your experience. 1-866-780-9100. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, with everyone from former President George W. Bush to Oprah Winfrey posting online videos of themselves dumping ice buckets of ice water over their heads in the name of charity. It's the Ice Bucket Challenge. You've probably heard of it. It continues to dominate social media, raising now somewhere around $70 million to date for ALS, commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease. And this hour, we're talking with Iowans who's have loved ones, have been struck by ALS, have died from ALS. So we want to find out more about this disease, raise our awareness about it, also from that personal level to also a medical level. We have with us Dr. Andrea Swenson of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, doctor of neuromuscular disorders, to answer our questions about it and about research. Rekha Basu, columnist for the Des Moines Register, with us. Her husband, Rob Borsellino, was diagnosed in 2004 and died a year and a half later from ALS. And we are so grateful to have her share that story. Our condolences to you, Rekha. I don't think I said that from the outset.
Thank you.
But we also want to welcome this hour to our studio in Iowa City, Leslie Nolte. Leslie, those around Eastern Iowa know you of the Dance Academy in Coralville. Correct?
They do. They do.
Very good. You are coming into our studio to tell us you've had two family members die from ALS, an uncle and your mother.
Yes.
I'm sorry to hear that, and our condolences to you.
Thank you.
Began in the summer of 2002. Tell us how it started in your case. What did you first start to notice, or your mother start to notice?
In my mom's case, her name is Marlene. She felt soreness in her knees, and she had just gotten off of course, watching my uncle have a similar case to Rekha's husband. It started with slurred speech. They, too, thought he was drinking. He lasted about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. So when my mom's knees were sore, she didn't equate it to ALS yet because it wasn't how her brothers started. And she went to all the orthopedic doctors, and, of course, the diagnosis came back as ALS, and they believe she was diagnosed quite early because, of course, she lived 7 years, which is up and beyond the norm.
This is unusual. Once diagnosed, you don't expect someone to live for 7 years. Is that what you were told?
Yes, we were told 2 to 5 years, and we were told we were luckier that it started in the limbs instead of the trunk. Our family equated it to the lucky ALS, where my uncle got the trunk not-so-lucky ALS. Mm. And we had seen the end stages of ALS with Uncle Dennis. And so because it started in the limbs, we had hope for probably the first 2 years that it was going to stop.
You had previous knowledge of it, unlike Rekha and Rob did. How was that? Was that that initial shock as bad? Could you talk about it?
Well, she was very, very confident that her ALS was going to be different than her brother's. And I think that's how she presented it to the family from the beginning. It started at, it's only my ankles, guys, don't worry. It's just my ankles. And who needs knees? Guys, we're still okay. It's just my knees. And so in hindsight, I think that, like anything else, we fooled ourselves for about the first 2 years. And then we knew it was going down the same path as her brothers. We just had, our path was 7 years long, and that path was a very strange and surreal and ultimately horrific experience when you look back.
I'm sorry to take you back to these painful memories, but it is so that we can better understand this disease. Do you have when you were pulled out of denial, do you have a day in mind that some function was lost that told you, Mom is going to be different from here out, and this is not coming back?
Yes, and some things we used to giggle about. We were told that 1% of your functions would end at a time, and you never knew what 1% that was going to be. Was it going to be a big toe, or was it going to be your left hand? We didn't know going into it, and you're told the scariest part, I think, was that you could plan for nothing, and everything was such a surprise. So when a non-moving ankle turned into an ankle brace. That was no real big deal. The day she almost drove through the garage was the day we had to say, Mom, you can't drive anymore. And the day she had to quit her job or, you know, get ready to leave her job that she'd been with for over 20 years. So when you have nothing to plan, you also cannot, you have no idea what's going to come next. So therefore, you can't have anything in place.
How did your mother want you to react to this? Because, of course, she is declining, but also very concerned about her family going on.
Yes. Her hardest part was the dignity and embarrassment that it caused for her, and she didn't want anyone to have to help. Now, of course, over 7 years, so many of us had to help, including buying a ranch house. My dad moved houses. My sister left her job to stay in-house with her. We had 4 years of in-house nurses. We had 9 months of long-term facility care. So I think the day that I knew my mom knew was when she called and she couldn't turn off her own light. And when you had these small discoveries along the way, you knew they were never going to come back. And so the day you could stop buttoning your shirt was the last time you could button your shirt. The day she could no longer button her pants was the day she had to begin taking someone with her to the bathroom. So every surprise, I guess, deletion of her ability, every time she was not able to do something, it was a surprise. On Wednesday, she could turn on and off her own lights, and on Thursday, she couldn't. So that was surprising. And for a planner, I think it would be more devastating. I'm not as much of a planner. So everything that happened, it was the phone call in the morning saying, well, Dad got me a bell because I can no longer stand up on my own. So it was just so long of constant surprises. And then it was always troubleshooting after the fact. The day she fell down and we had to call in the driveway and we had to call an ambulance because my father couldn't pick her up was the day we knew she couldn't get out of the car by herself. So it was just so many things. And for her, the hardest part for me was to see her embarrassed. And every step along the way was embarrassing, from having to yell someone's name to help her out of the bathroom to someone putting on her brake because she didn't like how fast she was going on her wheelchair. Everything, I think, was dignity. That the part of ALS that I actually liked the least was that she was so mentally intact until she wasn't. We were part of ALS that the dementia set in because she sort of lived too long with ALS.
Mm-hmm. Leslie Nolte is with us. Her mother and her uncle both died from ALS. We're learning about this disease this hour through these firsthand accounts of family members who've had loved ones die. Also, Rekha Basu with us at the Des Moines Register. If you'd like to join us, if you or your family have been touched by ALS, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, our email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Leslie, you mentioned the 7 years, unusual for a diagnosis of ALS, that your mother lived with ALS. You talked about the significant amount of caregiving that was needed, especially in those later years. Financially, what kind of impact did that make on your family? Were you in a position to absorb that financial cost?
Fortunately for my family, my dad was. We counted over $375,000 out of pocket for my mom over the course of the years. Insurance did pay for the doctor's visits and the prescriptions. She took the same medication that Rekha mentioned. And what happens is the ALS organizations around the country will offer you things like a Hoyer lift that is the lift that will pull you out of your chair, sit you onto either your wheelchair, or in my mom's case, it was the living room toilet, and then pick her back up. So there are so many things that the ALS organizations can help you with, but we needed a full-time nurse. We had someone live with my dad for 4 years. We then put her in a long-term care facility, which lasted 9 months until she passed away. That was about $7,000 a month for, you know, my dad had what he called, you know, mom's rent on top of his, you know, normal mortgage. So for my father, he could make it. We've had a lot of conversations in terms of how in the world could most families over the course of 6 or 7 years cash out, you know, $375,000 from the various places that he could cash it out to make this work. And, you know, between the changing of houses, that out-of-pocket cash, and my sister leaving her job to stay in-house with my mom alongside the nurse, it's pretty intense.
1-866-780-9100 if you'd like to join our conversation. About 10 minutes left of our conversation. I want to us to meet Abigail Costigan, chapter coordinator of the Iowa chapter of the ALS Association. Abigail, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Ben.
Tell us, let's jump right in. We've been hearing these very personal, painful stories of family members who have lost loved ones to ALS. I want to jump right to this ice bucket challenge with you. What has, in broad terms, been the impact on your chapter of, well, we're hearing numbers like $60 million raised since this ice bucket challenge went viral?
Yes, it's been absolutely amazing, the outreach and the outpour of supporters, both just by spreading awareness through obviously dumping ice-cold water on their heads and then again donating to their local chapter or our national organization. And like you had mentioned, I mean, the outpour for the donations is millions. And, you know, our association has never seen anything like this. And I don't think there's many associations that have. And it's just amazing. And then here locally, you know, we've obviously seen an increase in our donations as well. I believe the latest report we pulled were three times as high as donations at this time last year.
Tell us a little bit about your mission at the ALS Association, the Iowa chapter.
You know, our
what is
mission,
your work?
Yeah, our mission is just it's leading the fight to treat and cure ALS through global research, obviously. But then also we want to provide support to families here locally in Iowa that are affected by ALS. You know, we, like she had mentioned earlier, the loan closet as far as being able to, you know, hand out equipment for people when they need it. Because a disease like ALS, you may not need something one day, but the very next day you need a Hoyer lift to help you out of bed or whatever it may be. And our loan closet is a service that we provide to Iowans across the state free of charge. Whatever they may need, we will deliver it to their home. And then when they are done with it, we will pick it back up and put it back in our loan closet for someone else to use.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us roughly a breakdown on how much of a donation of a dollar is used for caregiving, that very valuable service, and also with research?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the donations that are raised here in Iowa, it's a total of, I believe, 86.5% that stays here locally in Iowa, and then the other 13.5% goes towards our national office to support public policy and research.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've certainly got wind of a bit of controversy in this, that American leaders of the Catholic Church have spoken out against its members taking part in this ice bucket challenge. Because the money donated to ALS could fund research using embryonic stem cells. That's a practice the church deems to be immoral. What's your reaction to that as the chapter coordinator of the Iowa ALS Association?
Yeah, I mean, the ALS Association primarily funds adult stem cell research. Currently, the association is funding one study using embryonic stem cell, and it is actually funded by one specific donor who is committed to that area of research. So, I mean, as far as somebody who does not want to any of their donation to go towards that, we are encouraging them to support their local organization or local chapter here in Iowa, because, like I mentioned before, 13.5% goes to national and every year, but the rest of it stays local to provide services for people who are affected with ALS.
Rekha Basu, you're a columnist. Do you have an opinion on most anything? Do you have an opinion on this bit of the controversy?
I mean, yes, of course I do. You know, back when Rob was diagnosed with ALS and we were dealing with this, there was a block on any kind of federal funding for research into embryonic stem cell research. And this was when President George W. Bush was in office. And I kept hearing from medical researchers and other people that the only hope, and I really firmly believed that the only hope for a cure for ALS came in the form of stem cell surgery ultimately. And at the time, there wasn't much work going on with adult stem cell surgery. It was just beginning. It was mostly the prospect was in embryonic stem cell surgery. And I have to say that, you know, the idea of worrying about, you know, about tissues from an embryo that is never going to be brought to term anyway is just, you know, to save a life. It's just so sad that we would prioritize something that's ideological in nature over someone who is dying and could really benefit from the funding and the research. So I'm very sorry that the Catholic Church feels this way, and I'm disappointed as well, because I like to think that the Church believes in helping people and believes in saving lives where possible.
Let's go quickly to our phones before this hour ends and we get some concluding remarks looking forward here. Rose is with us from Muscatine. Hi, Rose. What is your perspective on ALS?
Well, I'm sitting here listening to this conversation, and my grandfather died of ALS back in 1970, and I'm listening to you all talk about this, and memories just flood back, and I'm sitting here just in tears because so many of the memories come back, how debilitating it was, how there was back in 1965 or 66 when he was diagnosed, there was no funding, there was no help for families, there was nothing like that for my grandmother and my mother to help my grandfather.
So what do you...
grandchildren would go in and live with grandma and grandpa and help him at home and with his work. And it just... when I listen, I'm Catholic, and I'm so saddened to hear what the Catholic Church stance is on this. It's just another reason for me as a Catholic to turn away from the Church. And I'm sorry I'm just rattling on, but I'm listening to all of this, and I wish that the people in the Church, the bishops and the cardinals, would listen to people like me who had to live with this and still live with it. My family lives with the fear of having ALS in our family. And I'm sorry, I just rambling on.
Thank you, Rose. We are running a little bit out of time, but we do appreciate your input in our program today. Rose from Muscatine, thank you. Dr. Swenson, as a doctor of neuromuscular disorders at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, give us a look forward as we start to end this hour about the type of research going on, the strides that have been made. Hopefully you can give us some hope that this disease will, in the near future, be conquered.
So I think the research needs to focus on two things. One is to learn more about the disease, what actually causes the disease, who might be at risk. The other is looking for a cure, which sometimes may be difficult when we don't know the exact mechanisms of the disease and what's going on. But there's a lot of effort being put into different types of medications that can potentially slow down disease progression. There's also upcoming trials that will look into stem cells, see if those will help, again, with survival and disease, slowing down disease progression. For the known familial types of ALS, gene therapies are looking promising, and those have been used in animal models, and hopefully they will be translated into humans soon.
Can you tell us what difference this spike of donations will make to research? You may not have knowledgeable about that, but what do you guess there? I'm really asking is, where is the money coming from research, as you just described?
So it comes from fundraisers, as you see here, through the ALS Association. There's also the MDA, which is the Muscular Dystrophy Association, which has an ALS chapter, and they also have grants available for ALS research. There is some money coming from the National Institutes of Health. There's also drug companies that are funding research. And then also private donors are putting a lot of money into ALS advancement.
I guess overall, how will this ice bucket challenge the challenge that ALS poses to us, Dr. Swenson, if at all? Do you see it as a lasting effect on the fight against ALS?
I do. I think a fundraiser like this is really helpful. This is a great way to raise money to put into research, and I'm just really happy to see it so successful and popular.
Abigail Costigan of the Iowa chapter of the ALS Association, what do you see when you go forward with all this extra revenue coming toward ALS, helping those families cope with it, also helping the victims of ALS and also toward research. What do you see in the future?
I mean, the support that we've seen, both, like I said, funding and just awareness, is so huge for our organization. And I hope to see, like Dr. Swenson said, great things to come from the funds as far as research goes. And then here locally on an Iowa chapter level, we hope that, and we know that these funds that we're receiving will go towards our care services that are so vitally important to for our chapter and for the quality of life of the people living with ALS here in Iowa.
Abigail Costigan, thank you for joining us. Also, Abigail is the chapter coordinator at the Iowa ALS Association. I want to thank all those involved this hour. Leslie Nolte, thank you for coming in to tell us your story. Rekha Basu, columnist for the Des Moines Register, thank you for being with us the entire hour.
Thank you. And can I just mention that October 4th will be the Walk to Defeat ALS at Principal Park that's being sponsored by the local chapter of the ALS Association.
Thank you.
So please walk. It's another old-fashioned way of raising money.
All right. Rekha, thank you for joining us. And also thanks to Dr. Andrea Swenson of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Thank you for telling us about this awful disease, Dr. Swenson.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about preventing sexual assault. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. In Des Moines, help from John Pemble. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Here now, coming up next at 1 from WBUR in Boston and NPR News. And the showers and scattered storms.